You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
No, there's no music.
Oh, okay. Good morning, West Hill. Sorry I was late. I'm usually accompanied by music. That's my key. Anyway, welcome to this rather frosty Sunday morning. Welcome to West Hill. For all of you who are regulars, welcome to West Hill. For those of you who may be visiting for the first time, and welcome to those who come when they can. We call West Hill our home, and I hope that today, for the next couple of hours, you will enjoy the community that we have here and have the opportunity to call this place your home for Sunday afternoon or Sunday morning. We wish to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the First Credit First Nations, lands which were previously occupied by the Seneca, Huron, Wendat First Nations.
Being grounded in life with no escape from reality is a very hard thing to do. And little escapes are often quite necessary, but big escapes leave us quite floundering. We ground ourselves in life as it is, the economy, the environment, relationships, everything, and we could go either way and sometimes do with that. Sometimes we enter that web with a positive influence, and sometimes we just sit there and take up space, and sometimes we actually knock it about a bit. And so we just keep reminding ourselves to pledge or commit or whatever word you use, to say, I want to be in this life with a loving impact in all the ways that is of compassion and just and kindness and caring. And because we need wisdom, you're sitting where you're sitting, wherever you are in life, beside somebody with some wisdom to share and with whom you can share.
The reading selected today for today is from the book This Book Will Make You Fearless, by Joe Ushmar. Feeling afraid at certain moments is totally and utterly normal. Fear keeps us safe, stops us from strolling across a motorway, setting fire to our hair, or walking down a dark, dingy alley alone at night. It's also normal. It's a normal reaction to doing something new, to being put under pressure, or to deliberately freaking yourself out. If you are faced with something frightening, but you trust you aren't going to be in any danger, your physical response can act to be quite enjoyable. This is why we take part in extreme sports, go on roller coasters, and watch horror films. However, sometimes fear can be carried away with itself and materialize too regularly over things that don't warrant it. Fear is a sly beast. It can sneak its way into all areas of our lives, making everything even seem harder and less achievable. Offered for wisdom for the journey.
Somehow I came to the almost ridiculous decision to create my perspectives with paper and pencil instead of electronically. And electronically, you can cut and paste and move things around. Paper, you have to like do arrows and things. So I really have no idea where I'm going today, and I hope that you will remind me to use the computer next week. But it's funny how things that are being read in the gathering, I've chosen most of the time, but it's not until I hear them that I go, oh, ho. And I wanted to tell you, many of you know that I wanted to be a nuclear physicist when I was a kid, completely stymied by a failure in physics in first year university. But I was always trying to figure out how things worked. So I was working in this dairy counter place, you know, making ice cream and grilled cheese sandwiches and things for people. And I was playing with a lighter one time, and I'm listening to it. You know, like when you pulled the little handle down, it, and I wanted to find out if it made the same noise if it was lit. So I went and up the side of my head so that, you know, the fear of setting your hair on fire. Yeah, I didn't notice that when I picked the reading, but when I heard you read it, I thought, oh, yeah. Yeah, anyway, so we've all done things like that. And Scott did the first part of my perspectives because I wanted to talk about the difference in our upbringing and what it is that our parents did that created for Scott and I a very different capacity for engaging life in the ways that we each do. And Scott noted for you that he grew up in a family that was very, very focused on raising their children and providing them tools for living. My parents were very busy feeding us and making sure we didn't, you know, kill ourselves running out into the street or something like that, but didn't really offer us the same kind of tools. So Scott's family allowed him to grow up with the understanding that he wasn't the only person in the room, and he had much to do to understand what's going on in relationships between him and the other person. And so third time is, you know, the best. In our relationship, he's constantly calling me to account, right? And I'm obliviously just living my life out loud in the space, and he'll say, well, you know, we need to actually think about some of that, and this is what you can bring to it. And so I have learned an incredible amount from him, but over the 4 months that I was on full-time leave between March and June, I learned a lot just myself without his input. Thank you very much. And now I'm working to keep some of that in place. But one of the things that Scott said very early on, probably before we were even married, he said, you know, just because I'm in a bad mood, it's not okay to take your bad mood out on other people, right? If you're not feeling up to things, you don't make them feel, you know, that's your mood, so you don't have a right to impose it on other people. I had never heard that, ever. Like, I figured everybody was supposed to be where I was in that minute. So, which is not entirely true. I mean, I'd figure some of that out myself, but that he had been taught that as a child was intriguing to me. So one of the things he did when I was on leave was bring me this book by Joe Usman, the book on, you know, if this book will make you fearless, and invited me to look at it. And I'm thinking, you know, there's no one who's more fearless than I am. Like, I can take down almost anything, even big institutions, apparently. So I'm seriously not, I don't need this book. But I started reading it, and I was captivated by some of the things that it offered me. And so I'm going to share some of that with you today, because I think it's relevant to what we do here and what I do personally in my work with you and beyond this place related to that. But I imagine it's probably something that each of you could engage in your own lives as well and find helpful. In the first chapter, which is where Randy read from, the first segment about what fear is really about, and we all know that fear is what keeps you from, you know, running out in the street and being killed and things like that. And I often used to say that childhood, you know, being a parent, the first couple of years was 24-hour suicide prevention because children were constantly trying to do things that would limit their days on this earth, right? So we learn the things that we need to sort of stay away from that are not safe, and we incorporate them into our lives and we act accordingly. But there are also fears that we incorporate that are not maybe as helpful as they might be in terms of saving our lives. They actually get in the way of us knowing and experiencing our lives. When I was in my early 20s, I was living in the Northwest Territories in Inuvik, tiny little town, Canadian Forces Station. There were about 5,000 people there when I was there. The Forces Station left a couple of years after I left, so I think it's much smaller now. But there is a road to Tuktoyaktuk now. If anyone wants to drive up the Dempster, you can get all the way to Tuktoyaktuk, which you couldn't when I lived there back in the 1980s. In fact, I lived there the first year that the Dempster Highway opened. I lived there, and we drove down to Dawson City, which was amazing, and drove back up. But while I was there, I came to develop a total fear of being at the grocery store or being in other places where I wasn't sure who else was there. And I developed what is called agoraphobia. And agoraphobia, actually agora is the Greek word for market, so it's fear of a marketplace. But many people think of agoraphobia as fear of open spaces. It's much more complex than that. It often happens if you think you can't get out of a place safely, which I think is what was going on with me, when I couldn't get out of a place safely, or I wasn't sure how I was going to get out of a place. And I would find myself holding some grocery item and backed into a corner in the store trying to negotiate where I was going. I think some of it came much earlier than that, but that's sort of the first memory of that. But I remember as I was when I'm at university, and I'm walking down the road with some of my classmates, and one of them says, "Greta, you look awful. Are you okay?" And I lit into him because I didn't have any makeup on, right? It was the first time I'd been out without makeup on, right? But that embedded itself in me so significantly that when I went out just this past week and I forgot to put eyebrow pencil on, I was horrified and so afraid someone was going to notice it. I often joke that my children wouldn't nurse unless I had my makeup on, right? that I was so convinced that people would judge me if I didn't look the way I was supposed to look, that became a focus of my attention. My mom allowed me to go to the drugstore and buy makeup when I was 12. So I've been wearing makeup since I was 12 years old. I was a sickly-looking little kid, so that's why I think she was helping me along there. But I've ended up with that, and then this person at university, this sense that I was being judged by people around me that led me to this place of agoraphobia. Agoraphobia is the second of the top phobias. The first one is social phobias, and agoraphobia is certainly a significant part of that. The next one is acrobophobia, which is fear of acrobats, which is not really true, is the fear of heights, right? So I happen to personally know that there are people in this room who are also afraid of heights. And there may be people in this room who have a social phobia. And I was taken by that statistic because I don't think 50 years ago that would have had such a high number of people who are afraid. We have created, and Scott and I were talking about, the impact of television, which has set for us a standard by which we are supposed to live, and how if we can't live according to that standard, we feel inadequate and we are afraid to go out. And so we are afraid to be with people. We're afraid to not have our makeup on. We're afraid to have forgotten to reapply our lipstick before we had the picture taken. So that social phobia thing, I think, is perhaps fairly new, though I didn't actually do any research to figure that out, but it did strike me as peculiar. I thought that the biggest fear was speaking in public, and I had that one, you know, nailed, right? But no, it's a social phobia and agoraphobia and acrobophobia. And arachnophobia is another big one. And I think that's fairly primitive for many of us. So I wanted you to think, so that I can work through the stuff that Usman talks about in that first chapter, I want you to think of one of the things that you are afraid of happening. What's something you're afraid of happening? I don't need you to share it with people. If you want to, you're welcome to. But just to have something in your mind that you're afraid of. And I think more in terms of things that we're afraid of doing, or things that we're afraid of happening, things we're afraid that will occur, things that we're afraid of in the future. And a lot of what was spoken of in our sharing time speaks to it, a lot of those fears. How many people in this room are afraid of growing old and what that will do? And the rest of you are old? What is that? Put your hands up. Everybody's afraid of being old. Right. We're all afraid of getting old. We're all afraid of what will happen. We're all afraid of how we're going to respond to it. We're all afraid of, you know, what things will look like when we lose our faculties, when we lose our freedom and end up in a long-term care facility. When I tell people I have to do a steroid nasal rinse twice a day, and I've said to Scott, you know, it's physician-assisted dying the minute someone else has to come at me with that bottle to squirt water up my nose. Like, that is not happening. I'm not letting that happen. So we've got that all. He knows that that's the key moment, right? Because I could just imagine what that fight with someone with dementia would be like, trying to squirt water up their nose. Like, it's not going to go well. So we'll just make it not happen. But we all have things that we're afraid of. So you've got that in your head. Not necessarily the growing old, but you've got it in your head. Whatever that is, Erstmann points out that that's a situational phobia. That's a situational fear. You're afraid of something happening. It may be that you're afraid of having to meet new people. You're afraid of not having enough money when you go through the checkout at the grocery store. You're afraid of meeting your in-laws. You're afraid of having to live alone. You're afraid of your children leaving home and never calling back to say, hey there, how you doing? We're afraid of having to call somebody and ask them for money. Those are all situational fears. There's something's going to happen. We're afraid of getting old. That's going to happen. I'm afraid of that. So what is below that, and I want you to think about your fear, what is below that is an emotional reason. There's an emotionality that's attached to that situational fear. I'm afraid that I'll be embarrassed. I'm afraid that I'll look greedy. I'm afraid that I'll look needy. I'm afraid that I will be humiliated. I'm afraid that I will stand out like a sore thumb and be embarrassed. I'm afraid of all those kinds of things. So take a second, and without telling what your fear is, maybe call out what, if you were to look for the emotional impetus that underlies that fear, what is it? Can you share what those might be? Your emotional, what's the emotional reality behind that fear? I'm loneliness. Sad. Acceptance, lack of control, right? Mm-hmm. Letting people down, yeah. There's an emotional reality in almost every moment of our day. We often don't pay attention to it because we're so busy doing something. And we get so comfortable not checking in with our emotions that we let the result of those emotions take precedence. That's how we live, right? I'm just doing this, right? And I'm not doing that. And we don't take the time to get underneath it and think, what is that emotion about? And that's, I think, when I'm talking about what Scott's upbringing and my upbringing were like, he was invited to explore his feelings. I was told to stifle my feelings. I loved my parents most of the time. But they didn't invite that emotional engagement, right? They had 4 kids under 5 at one point. And my mom, I don't even know how she survived that, actually. And I know a bunch of you probably had 4 kids, or close to that, or maybe even more, and survived. And kudos, total kudos. But my mom was barely hanging on. She shared with us later that when Dad got home from work, and he was self-employed, so she never knew when that was going to be, when was he going to walk in the door, she was terrified of being caught lying down on the couch or trying to catch a moment's rest, right? So she just kept going all the time. So in that frantic pace, she was afraid of being caught by him and looking like she wasn't taking care of the kids. She was afraid of being embarrassed about that, of him not loving her because she wasn't taking care of the kids well enough. I don't even know if he knew he had kids at that point. But she certainly did. And so she was in a constant state of anxiety trying to care for us in a way that she thought my father expected her to, and he probably would never have even noticed, quite seriously. He wouldn't have noticed. But she incorporated that fear so significantly that it took over the ways that she was able to parent us, keeping us busy, teaching us crafts, being, you know, the mom that baked all the home cookies, things like that as a parent are what she did. Scott's parents sat him down and said, okay, let's account for that behavior, honey bunch, and would have to explain it. And then they'd say, well, it's not okay to do that. Why is it not okay? These are the reasons it's not okay. When I raised my daughter, every time she did something wrong, I would say, you're not to do that, and this is why. Or I'd say, no, and this is why. And I thought that I was embedding in her the belief that if I said no, she'd just know that there was a good reason behind it and she could stop. That doesn't work, I just want you to know. They still want a reason, and it never ends. So a different strategy might be helpful. But I think that not having that grounded sense of the permission to look at my emotions, to explore them, to have them validated but limited, and I would be responsible for that limitation, because that didn't happen, I ended up developing anxieties, phobias, and realities that have limited me. Over the course of the time that I was away, that I was on leave, I realized probably for several months I'd not gone out of the house by myself without someone or without a real reason that I had to go out of the house. I wasn't able to get out the door. Now, if somebody was going to, you know, join up the names with the list of things that they're like, how many people would have joined my name to can't get out the front door? You wouldn't do that. I'm very skilled at hiding what my limitations are. But we all have things like that that we run into. Everyone but Scott, who was raised beautifully by his parents. I have introduced him to a few shortcomings that he has. and enjoyed doing it. We learn together. But it has been an important time. Okay, so take that emotional underpinning of your fear, that your cell phone will start ringing in the middle of a gathering, not somebody's fear. But take that emotional thing. What comes underneath that? Why have you got that? Fear of humiliation means you're afraid of inviting someone out for a date, or fear of being rejected, or fear of being made fun of, so you won't stand up and give a speech. What's underneath that? What's underneath that humiliation, that embarrassment, that fear? Insecurity. Usman uses the phrase, I won't be able to cope. I won't be able to cope. And he takes that huge tree of the gazillions of things that we're afraid of as a human family, and he brings them down to that emotional base, and then he brings them down to that one single thing. I'm afraid I won't be able to cope. That is the bottom of everything that limits us. Some of them, really good limitations. And some of them ways that we have forced our hearts and our lives into boxes that prevent us from moving into places that we really need to be. I'm still not getting out of the house very well. I did a couple of times, but mostly I need to have a reason. And mostly I'm still working on that. And mostly it's because I'm afraid that a situation's going to happen that I'm not going to be able to cope with. I have the behaviors, that are required for coping in public down pretty well. I shared with you a few weeks ago that one of the learning goals that my committee at when I was studying and doing my internship, one of the learning goals was that I learned to mingle with people, that I get over being an introvert and find ways to talk to people about anything at any time. I have those skills. But having the skills doesn't necessarily get rid of that fear. And it certainly doesn't get rid of that originating, I don't know if I'm going to cope. I don't know if I'll be able to do it. I don't know if I'll be all right. And so I create an emotional response, and then I create a box that I'm in that I don't have to get out of, and I'm safe. I don't even know where to go with this at this point. I'm just standing here in front of you as someone who, just like you, has shit that goes on in their lives, has the difficulty, has challenges that we've run into that have completely bowled us over. And one thing that I do know, even as someone who is afraid, is that finding a way to be with someone in your fear, even if being with someone is what you're afraid of, is hugely important. And that when we do that multiple times with multiple people, and we find communities like this of people that will respect what it is that drives you, respect what it is that confines you, and still allow you to be in relationship, that more than anything else, will help you out of that box. Will help you find the world again, will help you engage that world in ways that are meaningful and positive, not just for yourself, but for that community and for the world around you. We all are confined in certain ways. If I asked someone to stand up and tell me how they're confined, it would probably be the one person who doesn't have anything that confines them. So I'm not going to do that, and I wouldn't do that. But I invite you to, as Scott has learned to do, because he's known it for so long, to allow your heart to be open to those who are broken, who are limited, even if by themselves, even if the limitation is imaginary, because all of us are just trying to find out how to cope. We're all worried that we might not be able to, but we're all here for one another, in case we can't. Thank you.
We've chosen a song that I think matches, from my perspective anyway, the idea that we are collectively, whether we like it or not, vulnerable. And in spite of that, if we're lucky and guided, find that our resilience is our strength. She's been there. I know she's been there. She has seen and done it all. She's a woman, and she knows how to dish it out or take it all. Her heart's as soft as feathers, still she weathers stormy skies. She's a sparrow. And she's a needle when she finds a kaleidoscope of colors. You can toss her round and round. You can keep her in your vision, but you'll never keep her down. She's a lover, and she's a mother. She's a friend, and she's a wife. and she's a sparrow and she's broken, but she's an eagle when she flies. Gentle as the sweet magnolia, strong as steel, her faith and pride. She's an everlasting shoulder, she's the leading post of life. She hurts deep, and when she weeps, she's as fragile as a child. And she's a sparrow when she's broken, and she's a when she flies. She's a sparrow when she's broken, but she's an eagle when she
So I'm just going to do a little introduction here, and then Scott's going to take over. Today is a special day, because we're celebrating Greta's 25 years as an ordained minister. I want to thank absolutely every one of you, because we knew about this and you kept it a secret. Greta actually commented at the beginning of service, there's so many people here. Maybe they thought the visitors and travelers lunch was this long. So she started fretting over that. This whole concept and the idea is Scott's. So I just have the opportunity to be the first one to say something. I've been on the board with Greta for numerous years. There are many people that have been, that are sitting here today, who have participated with her at the boards. And I know that she's on a number of different boards outside of this organization. But the one thing I want to recognize, that as I truly believe the ordination was her calling, because it has allowed her to flourish, and I am totally impressed by the fact that she has such a strong spirit for not accepting the status quo. And that perspective has been contagious, because it's driven multiple activities and leadership in many places where she touches. And so I know in the 25 years of ordination, she's had the opportunity of the stage, but I truly want to thank her for, on behalf of all of the members of past boards, current boards, and future boards, that the spirit will continue, because the status quo is not acceptable, and she has recognized that, and in my own view, that's what her calling has been. So on behalf of all of those board members, thank you, Greta.
Now I'm wondering if, Greta, I think you'd see much better if you sit down here with me. You can help me with the script. Bibette, could you come here and hold that the whole time? Put the chair there. Right. Okay. 25 years of ordination began with the first slide. It was a very uneventful year. There we go. Well, that was the introductory slide there. Began with Mom and Dad taking her to United Church of Canada, which was very close, if I think, very close by. The next slide is Sydenham Street. The next slide is St. Margaret's, I think, which is now called Crossroads. It's changed. They've amalgamated. The next slide is where she went to theological college. You can tell that they taught very old ideas.
They did not.
I know. They taught very progressive ideas in a very old building, and that was the start of it all. The next slide is a graduation picture of Greta. She's on the right. Greta's first ordained position was as a student, or preordained. I might have some of this wrong, which... No, I've had it here. Is in St. Matthew's Church, and this is the historic, next slide, the steeple of that church. And the next one she went to was here. Next slide, please. There she is sitting with us. One of the first projects they took on here, it was the next slide, was Kingston Road and the motels in the area with matching bracelets from one to another in the community. The next slide is... It was last year. No, I guess that wasn't last year. That was a long time ago. You're going to see some pictures of a long time ago in the 25 years. And there's some of them are a bit scrambled. Next picture. There she is on outside the sign, loving our sign. Next. The John Oakley Show with Charles McVitie, who was a raving liberal, a fundamentalist. No, just kidding. Fundamentalist beside the next slide, Greta, who was not. Some of the things she's instituted during here are, and you'll know right away with the next slide, on the back wall, the Tree of Transformation. The next slide is there's the celebrated lives that we do here. The next slide is the Longest Night, which I hope you've participated in. And I think the next couple of slides are the Longest Night and different. Isn't that gorgeous, Alan? You're in there somewhere. I saw you in there. Next slide. Train wreck. Came to the basement. Next slide. Drumming came. Next slide. A bazaar. The bazaar. And you're in there, and I can't really see, but it's some of us. Joan, that you're in there. And then the next slide is when you went to Parliament. And then at home here, the next slide shows the ribbons of the call to action. Another slide is refugee work. Another slide is you. Another slide is when the Guardian came to visit West Hill, and I asked, why would the Guardian from Britain come to a little church here? And they said, because you're asking one of the primary human questions. What do I have to do to be a good human being? And you're answering it differently than most churches. And so that's why they came, and that's why they did what they did. Next slide. Greta did the Q&A for the play Unholy. Next slide. Do you Moses Neimer idea. She was Idea City speaker. Next slide. That's Moses Neimer, and he told her she spoke like a dancer. He's watching very closely. Next slide. Bigger than Jesus. You did the Q&A for Rick Miller's first Bigger Than Jesus. Next slide. Clergy project for ministers who have gone belong belief and need some support. And there she is on the board, the founding board, I believe, or one of the newer board members. Next slide. That is the Walrus Talks. She was on the Walrus Talks, which got me introduced to that magazine, which is great. Next slide. Is the top one there is CBC, and the next one is CTV News. Next slide is valedictorian, the speaker at Centennial College, and then she became a board member of the Centennial, and that's the picture they use for the on one of their websites. Next one, that is Zoomer Television Toronto. Next one is Halton Peel Humanists. She spoke at. Objecting to their humanistic idea. No. Next one. Paul Kennedy Ideas. Some of you came downtown to see her on the panel on the topic of religion. Next one, she Tapestry CBC Radio with Mary Hines. Next one is some older people walking together there. there's our Christy guest. But at one time in the cancer walk, Greta actually did her sermon while she was walking in the cancer walk. So I put that slide up. The next one is The Observer, which has contained a few articles about her over the years, and a few little letters to the editor have come in. Bishop Spong says that's the only time he likes reading The Observer is when Greta's being criticized or something, and it makes it more entertaining. So, next slide. West Hill United, church that's out there, and these next few slides, and I'm out there, is when you have very warmly sent Greta and released her to go all over the world, and here are some of the slides of her work there. That is Birmingham Baptist in London. Next slide. Oxford University Chapel. Oh, sorry, no, I got it mixed up. There's the Oxford University Chapel. The one before was the Quaker Meeting House in Oxford. The next one is London, a big church in London. The next one is is Don Cupid, the author Don Cupid, who's one-third of my dissertation, the most progressive writer in the world. We met him in his office. Next slide. Next slide. Oh, it was a movie. Sorry. You can't really see this, but this is him in his wheelchair, in his scooter, and Greta's walking with him and chatting on the grounds of Oxford University, which was a total privilege. There he is signing one of his books for her, which is total. This is PCN, Progressive Christian Network Britain, where Greta spoke at Cars Lane Church. And this is PCN Britain in Leeds, where she spoke in Leeds, and this was just recently, to a marvelously receptive audience. And the next slide just shows some of the people. I know they're small. Some of the people, there's me playing the piano. And the next slide is, now, John and Anne McKechnie don't come here very often, and they use the excuse because they live in Scotland. Well, they do come when they can, and they were here last week, and they're here next week, but they're in Hamilton right now, but they are sitting on Greta's right in this discussion group in Leeds, having driven down a shorter commute from Scotland to be with us for that discussion, which went very well. Next slide is the With or Without God to... that's London. The next slide is Common Dreams, which took her to Australia, where she spoke in Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, Canberra, Adelaide, and I can't remember where else. And it went extremely well. And the next slide are the Sea of Faith people in New Zealand. We hopped over the planet. Sorry, this is back to Australia. That's just two people. Yes, this is a high Anglican priest, and we had dinner with him and his wife, and at a restaurant. And he's very high, very very high, like liturgical. Like he does lots of ceremonies, but he says he's the most progressive person there. So when Greta was talking to him, he looked like on the left-hand side. But when I was talking to him, he looked like on the right-hand side. And Greta kept kicking me under the table because I would ask him about his costumes. And she said I shouldn't call them costumes. I should call them... Next slide, please. I'm being very brave.
He grew up perfectly. Parents did everything they could.
That's Rex Hunt and Chris Page from Australia. Next one. There she was in New Zealand and says spoken in Auckland and Christchurch, later on at Wellington. And the people there, again, next slide. There she is in the middle on the white, and on her left is Lloyd Gearing. Sir Lloyd Gearing, they were co-speakers at this conference and fell in love with each other, and the next slide shows that they did, and that is Lloyd Gearing, who is 100 years old. He was the last man in the British Empire to be tried for heresy and was released. He has been supportive of Greta in so many ways. Lovely, lovely couple, and I think we got them in his study. There's that we were in his home and had a lovely time with Sir Lloyd Gearing and Shirley. Lovely, lovely. Next slide. Now, in a botanical garden in New Zealand, we found a speaker's corner, and they had a code of conduct. If you got to speak in this speaker's corner, you had to behave yourself. So I had Greta read it first, and then, next slide, she got into this... the soapbox and spoke to no one at all in the botanical garden. That was the only time it didn't matter how she talked. Next slide. ProgressiveChristian.org in the States. That is Christopher Plummer, who has manages now the John Spong's newsletter, which Fred Plummer, sorry, lives in Oregon, and had her there to speak at a big conference there. Next slide. That is her doing an interview with Fred Plummer from our living room chair, which she now does that way. Next one is that is in Coral Gables, Miami, where they invited an atheist to preach in their pulpit. And a man came up to me and said, I wasn't going to come and hear your wife because in United States of America, being an atheist is on a par with demon worship, or worse, being un-American. But then when he heard her, he said, well, that's what I believe. So, next slide. Greta, I don't know where this is. It's in New Brunswick. It's called the Legacy Wall with all our values, all the values put on the wall. Next slide. I don't know where that is either. Next slide. This is the American Humanist Association where she's in that bridging that gap between those two. The next is the Embrace Conference in Portland, Oregon. And the rabbi Brian has his arm around her, and he's a progressive rabbi, and she's a progressive minister in the Christian church, and they became best friends while they were there. Next slide. This is the Imagine No Religion conference, where she is having a charismatic experience, evidently. Next is the lecture series, the University Congregational. This is all while she's been here, by the way. You've sent her out to this, and everywhere she goes, she talks about West Hill, of course. The next is, I know it's long. It's almost over, honey. That is Ron Klusmeyer. Lois, do you see Ron Klusmeyer, the pianist who's written many United Church songs? And he came to my music workshop and had these pictures taken with Greta. Then the next one was the United Church of Christ Conference in Seattle, Washington, where she met with people that wear robes. Next slide. That's signing some of her books. And the next slide is, after she would do this, we'd go for a walk and she would take the oddest pictures. That is her taking a picture of a sewer. The leaves, the ferns growing in the sewer. Yes, go on to the next picture. That was a little... that is her going into the next picture. That is her going into the launch of the Living for a Year Without God with Ryan Bell. The next one is the Atlanta Free Thought Hall. Atlanta, Georgia Free Thought Hall. Wonderful. And I took a picture in the window, next one, in the window, looking at her speaking, as if I was like sneaking, right? But I wasn't. And the next picture is her speaking, and they gobbled her up. And the next picture is the Progressive Seminar featuring Greta Vosper at the Southwest Conference, United Church of Canada. Next one is, we're going really fast, it's like a movie, right? Greta Vosper, the Atheist Minister podcast. Next one is the Ever Wonder Conference where Louise and Mike, you were with us out there, and some others were in Edmonton. And then I think one of them is the atheist that said she never felt welcome. The Jewish humanist, that's right, never felt welcome before. And the next slide is what they did there. And the next slide is the same. The next slide, I don't know where that is. And the next slide is the Mount the atheist minister something. And then the last slide is, this was just recently, the Mountaintop Lectures in Georgia. So we end with One of the greatest supporters that has been with her through this entire time is Jack Spong and his beautiful wife, who love her dearly and have supported her in the most amazing way, because he has stopped his language at a certain point and has said, Greta, go further. You go further. And he has supported her all the way. The next picture is two books. Because of him, she launched into writing. The next one is Sing It Forward, and the Time and Too Late doesn't show up as much in the dark there. And the next one is the three inspirational books she wrote. And the last one here is me. I am standing in front of a fountain in Adelaide, New Zealand, celebrating what she's doing, and I've always liked that shot. In this, our time of need, this is you, sitting outside Greta's review hearing, reading what she is saying inside the building, but not allowed to go in unless you had to go to the washroom, and even then it was very difficult, if you remember. And here's after the shot with Julian Falconer and Akosua standing on the hill in, and I had put down in my notes, in this our time of need, love abounded. And the next shot, and the next shot. We believe you and I can make a difference, Greta. Next shot, next shot, next shot, next shot. There. Rebecca, could you come here and hold this, please?
It doesn't fit.
This is a book of people from all over the world who knew about this and have written to congratulate you. And it's amazingly beautiful. It is also printed on sustainable paper made from sugar cane. I put that first so she'd read it first. And all I want to do is tell you that there's so many. You'll spend weeks reading these. They're beautiful. And there's more coming out here. There's more to come from overseas that haven't got here yet. But this one, I just wanted to point out, the administrator of my long-term care facility wrote, because she so admires what you do. I have two here from Sandra Griffiths from Leeds, and one from Julie and Chris Grove from Birmingham, who have sent a note. And then Joan McFadden, who has supported you all this time. Reverend Joan McFadden from Nova Scotia has been a colleague in support and care through this entire thing. Fran Oda is here. And I will just read you Nancy's. I hacked everything, honey. I've been sneaking around like crazy. I'm so sorry. I've been lying to you. I've been doing terrible things.
I was. What a great upbringing you had.
Oh, I know. Dear Greta, I am thrilled to celebrate this milestone in ministry with you. I honor your work and your work on this 25th anniversary of your ordination. Your integrity, honesty, courage, and compassion have shaped these remarkable decades in ministry in ways that surpass every standard of suitability and fitness for ministry that truly matters. I am privileged to know you as a colleague and a friend. Nancy Steves, Minister, Southminster Steinauer United Church. And I will just indulge, please indulge me for the last letter. From Sir Lloyd Gearing, New Zealand. Shirley and I send our warm congratulations to you, Greta, on the 25th anniversary of your ordination. I was ordained on my 25th birthday just over 75 years ago, and hope you will eventually do the same. You and I have come to share very similar beliefs about God, and I am glad you have been instrumental in bringing your West Hill congregation into the 21st century. Shirley and I attend St. Andrew's on the Terrace in Wellington, where many either share these beliefs or are not far from them. I have witnessed great change in the last century as secular or this worldly culture has gradually become better known. The reason to continue to go to church is no longer to worship a God in the traditional sense, but to celebrate the highest human values such as love, truth, compassion, honesty, and to be encouraged to practice them. We honor you for your courageous leadership in this respect. With our best wishes, Lloyd and Shirley. And now, bring on the cake.
This was sitting on the couch, and I had just noticed it this morning, thinking I need to take that thing home. This was my ordination stool, which I made out of a variety of pieces of fabric from my life. And I was to, whenever I wore it, it was to remind me that I had to be whole if I was going to be able to speak. That if I lopped off certain parts of myself, my emotional self, my femaleness, my intellect, if I lobbed off bits and pieces, that whoever I spoke to wouldn't get the whole of who I am. And so that's what the ordination stole. My previous costume was to remind me to do. And I remember when I stopped wearing it, I wasn't sure I'd be reminded of that every Sunday, because when I put it on, it reminded me of that. It was a concrete reminder. But I hope that when I have failed at that, that the times that I've managed to bring all of who I am into this place, that they have been worthy of you. When I speak to people about what goes on at West Hill and they say, well, you don't read the Bible. How do you choose what you're going to read? And I say, the only thing that we can bring into this space is what is worthy of the people who gather here. And so thank you for allowing me to be here and for acknowledging that. And thank you so much for this unexpected celebration. Thank you.
Listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.